So, and this is the problem, that the whole problem, again, I cannot state that enough, is the fact that our RDs are so bad. 75% of the things we think of do not bring sales, more sales in reality. If we would only have 10% more good IDs, or 10%, no, 10% less bad IDs, it will bring, in this analysis, 40% more growth. So by doing an explorative phase and a confirmative phase, you will definitely shift a lot of the bad IDs out of it already. Do in the confirmative a lot more good IDs testing. It's definitely going to be more than 10%, and then exponentially, you will definitely find an increase of your effectiveness of over 40%, right? Probably 80% more real growth added to your program. So this is very important.
Hi, it's Richard here from the Experiment Nation podcast. Today I've got a special guest. It's Bart Schutz from iLine Dialogue. He's one of the founding members of iLine Dialogue, one of the world's most renowned CRO agencies. It's been around since 2009, with a background in consumer psychology and a renowned guest on many podcasts and conferences. Welcome to the podcast, Bart.
Very glad to be here. Thank you for the introduction, me being a psychologist. I'm very proud to be one, actually.
Well, part of the reason why I wanted to interview you is because, iLine Dialogue's one of their main points of difference compared to other CRO agencies is the huge emphasis on, in-depth research into psychology and consumer behavior, and that's even in the kinds of tests that you run. So maybe just as a background, could you tell me some information about, how you got started in the world of CRO and agent life?
Yeah. So my background is obviously consumer psychology. I'm probably the worst psychologist you can get, because both my parents are psychologists. My only sister is a psychologist. I married a psychologist. Half of the company are psychologists. So let's say I just have a huge interest in human behavior. Since I was born, and when so I ran a, let's say my background very quickly is I started a usability testing company, qualitative research. I got into, but that's about back in the 90s, right? Internet was sort of still a niche and the new sexy. Then I got into online market research, which was more quantitative already. And then I got into consultancy to use the knowledge that we got from our research, online research, and combined with the insights from behavioral science to apply to on a more strategic level to companies. But then at some point, web data, web analytics became available. And I want to apply that. I'm a behavioral scientist. I love studying people's behavior. I'm not so much a fan of listening to what they say, because they don't do what they say, right? And they don't say what they do. So this availability of behavioral data, which became sort of ubiquitous, right? It was everywhere. That just gave me goosebumps, and I wanted to do something with it. But I was sort of a minor shareholder in the consultancy firm I was working for. We tried to buy two web analytics companies, but it didn't really work. And then one of my best friends, he was a witness at my wedding, right, that type level of best friend. He told me that he met this person by the name of Ton Wesseling, who was fully into web analytics and digital experimentation, A/B testing. So I needed to meet him, and so he sort of connected us. And 2 years later, the magic started happening, because I quit my job, and we started Online Dialogue. And my idea of the combining the insights from behavioral science together with the methods and tools that we had developed to study human behavior within behavioral science, and then the data available in the digital scene, that was so much fun. And it was a real, like, a thrill to work together with Ton Wesseling, who was available to make sense of all that data and run the experiments. And back in the early days, he was even still doing the coding of the experiments himself. And it was a lot of fun. absolutely was. Yeah.
Would you say that, I mean, you were the, so he was, it sounds like he was the technical arm of the company, being able to code up tests and run them and look at the data and analytics,
yeah,
and
you well were more the sort of data analysis, right? He did a lot of data analysis back. I wasn't even able to do a simple analysis within Google Analytics, or that was absolutely his part. And not only just to sort of analyze the experiments that we did, but also like the pre-analysis, how does the behavior look like? So we would really sit together, dive into the data, and he would sort of unveil all these click paths and the user journeys. And I saw where people switched off, and I saw the pages where they spent too much time. And then so I came up with the ideas, like, oh, it has to be this type of behavior. Maybe this uncertainty is at play. And he came with a lot of ideas himself as well, right?
Mm.
But that combination was really strong. And I have to say, I mean, we're not the only company. I mean, you're saying we're sort of the thought leader of...
you're one of them.
Yeah, right. But there's so many that also embrace this. I mean, it feels like we sort of started a movement, because there's a lot of, I think, attention. I think the average knowledge on how the brain makes decisions within the CRO scene is a lot higher than in a lot of other digital marketing scenes. I'm very proud of that. And I love it. And I love the fact that also, you know, we're a sharing community. Everyone shares ideas and
I like that aspect of it. Awesome intro. An awesome story. Our listeners have got a lot to learn from you in today's chat. I think the first thing you mentioned, before we went on the podcast is that a lot of CROs don't realize that I think a third to a half of their tests aren't actual winners. Could you explain that and explain the significance of that? And
yeah. So let me start with something else. I'm sorry. Within CRO, we do lots of types of research to unveil what is the best decision, right?
Yeah.
And the more users we have and the better our conversion rate, the more we are able to run A-B tests. So we do a lot of A-B testing within CRO, which is a very good thing. And for the listeners that are unaware of the hierarchy of evidence or the pyramid of evidence, try to look it up. Right, it's a scientific pyramid where they qualified the types of research that are available within science on the quality of the evidence. And the higher you go in the hierarchy, the higher the quality of the evidence, or as I prefer to say, the less risk you are taking by basing your decision on that type of research. So down on the bottom are expert opinions and more qualitative studies. Then halfway you get into the more data analysis type of studies, case studies, cross-sectional studies, case control studies, cohort studies. This is more the web analytics, where you see two segments, you compare them, and then you base your decision. But the highest in the pyramid is what they call in science the randomized controlled trial, which we call the A-B test, right?
Yes.
And then if I compare it to science, our numbers are usually even a lot bigger. We tend to have 100,000 of users in a randomized controlled trial or A-B test. That's unprecedented. The scale, the amount of it, the experiments that we run, the numbers of users, the power level that we have is unprecedented. So we should never stop using the A-B test, right? If you have enough users and statistical power, we should never stop using the A-B test as our primary tool to base decisions on. And we should make it faster, cheaper, better, of course. But, I want to start with that. Having said that, CRO scene is in a replication crisis.
Mm.
And our scene is not aware of the problem yet. And it's big. It's massive.
Mm.
I'm going to start with the replication crisis in itself on the winner side, but I'm the second thing I'm going to say is even more important. But so we find a lot of winners, right? Let's say you're working in a company, you run 100 A/B tests, and 25 of them are turning into winners.
Yeah.
Now, I experience with a lot of CRO experts that they somewhere are aware, mostly unaware, but to some, right, we have this feeling that somehow it cannot be true. All these winners, if we add them up, right? We have this feeling like maybe there's something decay, but we don't dive into it.
Yeah.
We sort of, it's a what we call a cognitive dissonance within behavioral science. It's an uncomfortable feeling. So it's an area where we're staying a little bit away from. And maybe for a reason, because if you would really dive into it, you would find that, yeah, on average, at least half of your winning experience is not a winning experiment. I spoke at the Dutch CRO Awards last week, on Thursday, and I asked for their significance levels in that, like within that group. And these were the best CRO with the best experimenting programs, etc. Yeah. It was actually 2/3 of the winning experiments that would not be, that are in reality not a winner. And you know, the thing is that very often the C-suite or your boss, he knows, because you know, he's running the hotel and the rooms are not fully booked, or he's running this web shop and the warehouse is not empty. But if he would add up all your experiments and all the business cases that are often presented, then it should be, right? But no one in digital marketing makes it a real problem, because in the other digital marketing channel, like in mail and search engine advertising or displays or social, we also have this attribution problem, and everyone says, oh, it's I caused the sale or the lead. And also they don't add up. So it's a bit sort of the status quo within digital marketing. But
so to clarify, the litmus test of whether or not, because you I did read your article about this, and would you say the litmus test of how you came to this conclusion that a third to a half of winning tests aren't winners, is it really just down to this is not really actually impacting our business for our primary KPI that we have, which is either sales or sales volume or whatever metric you're looking at?
Yeah. So let's just take an example. We're looking at sales.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, you're a CRO specialist. You work for an e-commerce platform, a web shop, and you're running experiments. You do 100 experiments, 25 of them are winners, according to the statistical method that you're using. Let's assume metrics, right? Let's assume you're running at a significance level of 90%.
Yeah.
Right? Last week, typically the audience was clarifying a winner above 80% already, but let's assume 90%.
Yeah.
If you're running experiments at 90%, and let's say it's one-sided. This is a bit statistical, right? And I never talk to statistics to people because they find it boring, but it's so
one-sided
important.
One-sided t-test, yeah.
One-sided, yeah. So, and when the p-value ends up below 0.1, alpha is 0.1, then you clarify the winner.
Yep.
Then people have this assumption that somewhere around 10% of the winners will not be a winner, but that's not the case, because the 10% threshold that we're using is for all the experiments that don't make any uplift in reality. So let's say you have 100 IDs, of which let's say 72 do nothing in reality, and 28 bring an uplift in reality. What you're trying to do with your experimental program is find the 28, right? But of the 78, because you use 90% significance level, 10%, so 7, will become, because of all the noise and the coincidence, will become a false winner, right? So significance is about the amount of bad IDs, no uplift, no growth, no extra sales IDs turning into a winner.
Mm.
Then we have 28 good IDs, which we want to find. But those will not become a winner, all of them, because you don't have the power. The same reason why you find false winners, you also find false losers. I call it missed growth or missed sales. And it's disturbing to see that we're not focusing on balancing this, because this is what the boss is asking us. Find me more sales, right?
Yeah.
So the problem is that probably one third of the good ideas will not turn into a winner because of the power levels. We tend to calculate with 80% power, but if you calculate it backwards, it's usually somewhere between at the most 65 or 70%. So a third at least of the good ideas will end up in the bin and will not, you know, be pushed live, and will, so you miss some growth. If I now look at the real winners and I combine it with the false winners, right?
Yep.
I usually, with a 90% significance level, come around 50% of false winners. And I can do the math for you. It'd be interesting to see how many people are going to react. But if people would contact me, or would I do it myself, it's not a very difficult calculation, but we need some of your metrics.
So false positives, like they are.
No, I just want to know the significance level. I just want to know the winner ratio.
Yeah.
And I need some indicators of the real power level. So I need a list of your experiments. I need the numbers in the variations, and then we can do the calculations ourselves, right? So if you just have the number of visitors per variation, the conversion rate per variation, we can do calculate what was the real power on average among your experiments. And then I can calculate these metrics. How many of the IDs were statistically seen? Good ideas that would have brought you sales in reality, how much of those are actually turned into a real winner? And from the ideas that bring no growth, how many turn into a false winner, right? And then you will see a very disturbing reality, because again, at 90% significance, half of your winners are no winners at all. Just over 10% of the false, of the losers, like, and which is usually most of them, right? We tend to have more inconclusive or negative results than we find winners. Around 10% actually are winners in reality.
Yeah.
And that's actually the biggest problem. So people are usually shocked when I tell them that half or usually even more of their winning experiments are no winners at all, just statistics, based on statistics. Mm-hmm. But it's not the problem, because pushing a winner live has very little cost, usually, right? So we have an experiment. We're an e-commerce, we're a web shop, we're selling, let's say, toys. We run an experiment. We include in the title of the toys, we include the age, the target age. So this is a toy and it's targeted at age 3 to 5 years. Maybe that's a winning ID, right? So we run the test, it's a winner, we push it live, perfect. But maybe it's not a good ID. Maybe it doesn't make any difference, right? We push it live, does nothing. How much did it cost? Right, maybe 4 hours to have IT check it, or let's say maybe even $1,000 or euros, whatever. It's the costs of a false winner tend to be very low,
because it's just production costs, isn't it? You're doing it yourself, or some developers doing it. So whatever. But the real money.
The real problem is basically what your boss is asking: find me real winners. A third of your winners, you don't find them, right? So and because science is so focused on the truth, they're so focused on, you know, excluding all false winners, false positives as they call it. But we're not into finding the truth. We're into finding the money, right? And the problem is that we tend to have only, let's say, 25 or 30% of good IDs. Of those good IDs, we don't want to miss any, because that's missed growth. That's you know, winning experiments in the bin. You don't want that. So we need more power, right? So I have this term which I call discovered positive rate of the positive experiments. How many of them do you discover? There's not even a word in science really for this. or, you know, discovered growth rate of the, and with 90% significance, it's around 75%. With 95% significance, so I see companies increasing their significance level nowadays because science is doing it. But no, you're missing out on more of your good ideas. The higher you bring your significance level, you're more strict. You will find less of the true winners. So you have to balance this. Normally, if I do the calculation, people have to lower their significance level, which increases the power. And therefore, you find more winners, and not only false winners, but also true winners.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you lower the significance level, you also increase the risk of getting false positives. You're basically trying to find the balance between false positives and false negatives, I'm guessing. So just to clarify for our audiences, finding that balance, I guess, is key, and you've got a lot of experience there. So the higher risk you say from you're posing from a business perspective is if the significance levels are too high, then you're gonna are you basically saying that you're gonna get more false negatives, right?
Yeah.
Which is money left on the table, which is basically winners that are declared false losers. False
negatives is a scientific term. So I tend to call it missed sales, right? Or missed growth.
Yeah.
Because that's if you're gonna talk to your boss, or if you're executive level yourself, right?
Yeah.
Don't talk science. People will disconnect, but if you talk business, they will stay connected. And if it's missed sales, everyone is awake.
Dollars and cents. Yeah.
Right. And if it's fake sales, okay, we know the costs of a fake growth or fake sale are not so high. But you know, if you could do the discussion with your boss, your executive, on the balance between maybe for the whole program, but preferably for every experiment, what would it cost to have a fake sale, a fake winner, which is just the execution of pushing the winner live, and what would it cost to have a missed sale outcome, right? A missed growth, a false negative. You will find out it's way more. So let's say a false negative, so missed growth, will cost you on average, if you look at your program, 100,000, whereas a false positive is only 1,000. Then I can do the calculation for you, or you dive into your statistics books from back in the university days. You can maybe find out yourself and come to the optimal alpha, the optimal significance level. And the funny thing is, you can do this for all the experiments you did back in the past, and you will actually increase your conversion rate without running any extra experiment. It's just doing the basics right, looking backwards. I wouldn't go too far backwards, but yeah.
What else would you say to people who listening to this? And I mean, maybe they don't they can't hire a statistician. Maybe they're in a small CRO team, or they don't have the resources. Or behavioral scientists like yourself, or
All behavioral scientists have a full year of statistics and research methods, so they should be able to do this. But to be very honest, even behavioral scientists, they think statistics was like the worst part of their studies. So, because to be really honest, I also studied physics, right? I love human behavior, but I'm also a very technical beta type of data guy too. So I actually like data and statistics, but there's more to it than just optimizing the significance and power level to do this balance. Because if I look back at 10, 12 years ago, the behavioral science world was in a shock.
Yeah,
because we found out this problem within science, right? We call it the replication crisis. That's why I call it the replication crisis of A/B testing nowadays. We're in exactly the same crisis as the empirical sciences, so behavioral science, but also medical science and biology, were back 10, 12 years ago. Now, most empirical science have gone through this renaissance. Biology, in all honesty, is still not really aware, but whatever. So we found a lot of ways to do this better, And so one of them was significance levels, which we in behavioral science now increase to 99%, and it's because we need to find the truth and we're not in finding more money. So in your business, do it, but you know, focus on finding the best alpha for not missing out on winners. But there are more ways. And one of the most important things that we do nowadays in behavioral science is to have this distinction, this separation between explorative studies or experiments and confirmative or validating experiments. So exploration, validation.
Yep.
And exploration brings a lot of fun to the CRO world if we would really start doing this, because exploration basically means instead of running one A/B test, you're going to run, let's say, 5 A/B tests on the same population. And everyone will say, or if, at least if you have a good understanding of statistics, they will say, oh, but then, you know, your power level drops, the chances of finding false positives increases. Yes, it's true. But let's say we ran this experiment, you know, A, B, C, D, E experiment.
On the same page, for instance?
On the same page, on the same group. So you just have a one-fifth of the original population to each experiment.
Yeah.
You find an outcome after, let's say, a week, right? And maybe there's a variation A is plus 1% and a minus 5%, plus 7%, minus 3%, plus 4%. There's one of them has plus 7% increase in conversion rate, right? Now, this is an indication within the explorative phase that this might actually be a good idea. So what are we going to do? We're going to validate whether that's right in the second phase. Mm-hmm. So we keep the experiment running for another week, but we close down all the other variations. So A, B, D, and E, but we're keeping C, because that was the in the explorative phase, the one with the highest uplift. And then we validate it with another week of experimenting. So just to validate that idea. Mm-hmm. Why is this so important? Why is this the way we work now in behavioral science? Because the problem of statistics is the fact that I was mentioning 72 bad ideas that bring no uplift, 20% or 28 from 100 good ideas that would bring sales in reality. That's the problem. The fact that we have so many ideas that bring no uplift in reality, right?
Yep.
By doing this explorative phase up front, we have a lot more good ideas that will bring uplift in reality in the second phase. So we're in the replicating phase, we have this division of 78 to 28 is maybe switched around, right? So maybe, or maybe even if it would only be 50-50, but we increased the chances of a winning experiment up front. And that has an exponential effect on the statistics of finding false discoveries, of finding false winners and false positives. And the bigger boys in the CRO scene, so all the Microsoft brands and companies like Booking, they're already doing this to have more explorative studies and then replicate or validate them in a confirmatory phase. But so we really have to sort of reinvent our approach to experimental design. We should stop doing one A/B test, right? We should look at it again. And within science, we do an A/B test twice or three times to be more sure, but you don't want that in business because you're gonna find too many inconclusives that would have been a winner in reality. Therefore, we should do this exploration, confirmation, distinction, and it will only bring more fun, because exploring, we love exploring. Yeah, you know, just come up with all your ideas, put them in one big jar and run 5 experiments at the same time. The chance of finding a winner are among them are pretty big. Yeah, it's also large chance that it's a fast winner, but that's why we replicate or confirm or validate, whatever you call it. Mm-hmm. And you will find more winners this way. There's a study which is, I think it's a lot of has a lot of value to it. It's yep. done by the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. The people are so if you want to bring more growth to your company, people look at this scientific article. It's from Berman and Van den Bulten. It's from 2021. And maybe mm-hmm. I can send you the URL to the PDF of their study. It's called False Discovery in A/B Testing. And it was published in Management Science. It's one of the most undervalued studies, I think, in the CRO world. And it explains everything I've been talking about in, I think, not even too hard to understand language. And they also proposed this way of doing experimental design, separating explorative phase and validating phase or confirmative phase. Mm-hmm. They also did a modulation. So they looked at, I think, almost 5,000 A/B tests or effect sizes within Optimizely data. So they just yep. got data from Optimizely. They ran all their analysis on the metric, I think it's engagement. So, you know, any click on the page. So you have to sort of realize that, because that's probably different than, because I hope most of the people are looking at conversion rates or sales in the end. But they yep. did this modulation. And what I loved about it is that if you would increase the real winners among your among your IDs, right, with only 10%. So instead of having 72 bad IDs and 28 good IDs in reality, mm-hmm. you would change it to 65 bad IDs and 35 good IDs. It's only a small uplift in experiments that would win in reality, right? You would, because of the exponential effect of it, you would find 40% more growth. So, and this is where, wow. This is the problem, that the whole problem, again, I cannot state that enough, is the fact that our RDs are so bad. You know, 75% of the things we think of do not bring sales, more sales in reality. Yeah. If we would only have 10% more good IDs, or 10% less bad IDs, it will bring, in this analysis, 40% more growth. So by doing an explorative phase and a confirmative phase, you yeah. will definitely shift a lot of the bad IDs out of it already. Do in the confirmative a lot more good IDs testing. It's definitely going to be more than 10%. And then, you know, exponentially, you will definitely find an increase of your effectiveness of over 40%, right? Probably 80% more real growth added to your program. So this is very important. Right? But you have to realize at first that all these winning experiments mm-hmm. don't add up. So just to set the scene, if you thought you brought a million extra revenue last year, yeah. I have bad news. It's probably maybe 300,000, right? But gosh. It's very easy to increase the 300,000 to let's say 600,000 by first setting your significance level according to the business rules, not the scientific rules, right? You have to calculate the optimal one. We can help mm-hmm. you with that. And you have to rethink your experimental design by adding an explorative and a confirmative phase to it.
It's very, yeah. very thorough explanation. I think a lot of people get a lot of value out of that. Hopefully we'll link. I think you did send me that PDF, so we can probably link it to the show notes later on.
I'm not sure if it's available for free, but
I think it sent me something, or it might have been.
I think so. Yeah.
Look, that leads me to another point in terms of trying to get more winners, and this is the use of applying consumer psychology to your tests. And I do know that you said that before the podcast that you've got a whole database yeah. of tests over the last 13 years. Most of them, would you say, not 80 to 90%, focus on system one as opposed to system two?
It's a bit more complicated, but I think that the point now is very easy. Why we are so focused on adding behavioral scientific insights to CRO programs Because again, if you would only find 10% more good ideas or less bad ideas, and I think everyone realizes that by having more scientific knowledge on how the brain makes decisions can probably increase the number of good ideas with 10%, right?
Can you explain to our audiences
40% more sales? Back in the early days, people said, it's only a small difference. Yeah, no, it's not. It's a small difference in the amount of good ideas, maybe, because even a psychologist or consumer, but even people like me who run thousands of experiments cannot predict with 100% certainty if an experiment will win or if it's a good idea or not. But I think we are slightly better.
Mm.
But I also think we have not a slightly effect on real increase in sales, because 10%, again, is 40% more sales. So that's why I'm really emphasizing companies to focus on how the brain works.
Yeah.
And I think I love the fact that we were talking about this before we started the podcast. I love the fact that within the whole digital scene, I think CRO is, I think, one of the thought leaders, front leaders in adding behavioral science to the way they operate. More than search engine advertising or any of the marketing channels. And I also think CRO should be, I think you talked about it with Tom, should be like the layer over all your at least digital activities, but even HR and all the business decisions should be based on evidence.
Mm.
But by applying behavioral science, you will truly understand what drives people. And it starts with the fact, as you were mentioning, that in the brain there's happening more than we are consciously aware, right? And I think more and more people are being, especially in the CRO scene, are aware of this. They know about system one and system two thinking, the distinction between conscious, rational, goal-directed decisions and the more unconscious or automated intuitive decisions. There's one thing I think is a fun fact, that is that we just discussed the false discoveries, the replication crisis within the CRO world, right? Mm. Daniel Kahneman wrote his book in 2012. He published in 2012. That was in the midst of the replication crisis within behavioral science. Daniel Kahneman says nowadays that if he would write his book again, it would be less than half as thick, because half or more than half of the studies in his book are underpowered and probably false discoveries.
Wow. It's a huge bloody book. It was like, I actually didn't end up finishing it. It was just so long. It was too much for me.
And if you're a behavioral scientist yourself, one of the funniest fun factors I think about it is that the first scientific publication that Kahneman had together with his late friend Tversky was about the belief in small numbers. So his very first scientific article was about the belief in small numbers. And then he wrote, like 30 years later, he wrote this massively impactful book. But half of the studies were based on small numbers. He was prone to his own bias that way. Yeah. Doesn't mean that the basic point of the book, that there's so much happening in our brain that we're not aware of and that's way more important than we are aware of in creating our decisions, still holds very strong. And that's the division between what we, because of Kahneman nowadays, call system two and system one thinking. So just a for the listeners, if you're not aware, let's say I'm asking you, how much is 2 and 2? Right? All of us instantly answers 4.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, we don't have to do the calculation anymore. It's automated.
Yeah.
Right? Because we are not looking at our fingers and doing 2 and 2 and 1, 2, 3, 4. No, it's automated answer. But if I ask you, like, how much is 16 times 24? I'm giving you a hard time.
Yeah,
you're probably going to multiply 24 by 10 and then adding and then trying to remember 240 and then doing 6 times. It's your smartphone has calculated this a trillion times in the same time that you take for it. The answer is, by the way, 384. But this is not an automated answer because you're not getting the question over. You don't have to do this calculation so often, 16 times 24. So maybe you experience a bit the two systems. We have a reflective automated, you don't have to think about it system, and a rational one, which you can actually do difficult calculations, but it takes a lot of time. It needs a lot of focus and attention, because if I would distract you by calling out random numbers, I think everyone knows that it would become harder. So those are the two systems. There's one other one for the native English people in the audience, which is not a scientific one, but I think it's a very funny one. My son came up to me and he asked me the following question. He said, "Dad, I have a question for you. Jack's dad has three sons. What are their names? Huey, Dewey, and
Louis."
Yeah, but if you think about it, because I go like, okay, Louis, but there has to be a trick to this, right? So I'm looking at my son like, where's the trick? And I go like, oh wait a minute, it's Jack's dad. One of them has to be Jack. So it's Huey, Dewey, and Jack. But I think this is sort of an elegant way to explain the same, right? You have this automated answers, automated behavior, automated decisions, but you also have a rational thinking that can inhibit these automated answers, think logically, and come up with, in this case, the right answer. So I was proud that I gave him the right answer, and he thought like, bugger, I didn't get him.
have you got any examples of system two tests that you thought wouldn't, well, that surprised you? So, I mean, there must be outliers where system two tests work well compared to system one tests. What kind of examples would you give to our audiences?
Right. So one of the examples that I like to use, that was one of the first experiments that we did 9 years ago or 13 years ago, is that there's very often, especially in the early days, we were still doing a lot of usability testing, qualitative research, and then we would run A/B tests as well. So it's I think it's fun to look at the outcomes of both, right?
Yeah.
So we've had a lot of experiments where in the qualitative usability test, people would say like, I don't like that, you shouldn't do that. Example, pop-ups. Right? Back in those days, we were still like this, the exit intent pop-ups, for example.
Yeah.
But we were even having still pop-ups when you enter the website. User testing would say, don't do that. It irritates people, right? They tell us that they would leave the website and prefer a website that does not have a entry pop-up upon entry. We found so many winners with having a pop-up upon entry on the website. And I'm not going to explain the scientific or the behavioral science background of it, but I think it shows already that there's a difference between what people think and what they do in reality.
Yeah.
Now, because we apply system one and system two thinking in online dialogue a lot, but we're going a bit more deep, because the thing is that you want to know up front whether you're dealing with users that are in conscious control of their behavior, system two type of users, or whether they are led by their intuition and automated and habits, for example, system one. And you can find it in the data. There's a lot of indicators that you have in the data, whether you have goal-directed, rational, in-control users or more intuitive users. So let's say if people would search on your page for a very specific product and they follow the ideal steps in your funnel from, you know, the search listing to the product page and then maybe a tab with a detail and then go to the checkout 1, 2, 3 and thank you page. That's very indicative for system two, rational, logical, in control type of behavior.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have people that are, you know, first of all, they came from social media where you placed an ad and you see them all over your website, clicking everywhere. Those people are not goal-directed, in control type of users. They are more the, you know, the emotional people that click whatever they like, and it's much more unconscious driven. That's the first indicator. So we start with the data, and then we start running experiments. I'd say within the system two, the rational one, we run three types of experiments. And for those who have who dived into behavioral science deeper, I think this is going to be they already know these three types, because it's based on BJ Fogg's behavioral model. I love the model. I had a professor back in the Netherlands. He's called Theo Poys. I want to give a big shout out to Theo Poys. He's retired. He's my main inspirer, because he had the same model. He was just not so good in marketing his model, but it were the same three pillars: ability, motivation, and then BJ Fogg calls it prompts, or used to call it triggers, whereas my professor had another name for it. Anyway, he called it attention. So I still call it attention. And these three behavioral drivers for rational thinking are very logical. If you realize, first, I start with attention. If you process information consciously and you're controlling it, you need to have focus and attention.
Yeah.
Right? Which is very hard nowadays. One of the biggest challenges we have is all these notifications, right? People are, even if they're on their laptop, they're still having their phone, or they're having these push notifications appear in their screen. People are very easily distracted nowadays. So we find a lot of winners just to make sure that people keep paying attention to the task at hand, right? So winning experiments will typically be using visual cues, arrows, you know, pictures in the forms of arrows towards the main, most important information or call to action, whatever is most relevant at the moment for these consciously in control people. Or we will just make things stand out with very shouting colors or movements. We just, right, as long as we keep their attention to the task at hand. Because if people are distracted, they're no longer in control of the task they were doing. That's one.
Yeah.
Second one is motivation. I think this one is the easiest one, because it's about, you know, the USPs of your product or of the let's say the toy you're selling in your web shop. So there's usually been a lot of thinking about motivation already, but motivation is also on a more psychological level. Because what also motivates people is things like autonomy, right? We are motivated if we feel autonomous in our decision. So I love to take out mandatory fields in forms, for example, right? And just see an increase, because people are less hurt in their need for autonomy. That's motivating for people. Mm. What's also motivating is what we call self-efficacy, which is an awkward term for just making people feel that they can do it, right?
Yep.
Anything with green check marks in forms, you know, just make the whole form field, the field itself, green. It's like a sort of tap on the shoulder. You know, treat them as if your users, as if they're your kids. Yeah,
it's
you're
like
doing
positive
good.
Positive reinforcement, right?
Positive reinforcement boosts their self-efficacy. Right, the fact that in booking.com, every step you go, yeah, you got the best price, and you're almost there. It's like,
yeah,
it's for those of you who have kids and they're doing sports and you see them on the field and you go like, oh, this is so bad. What are you going to say? You're going to tell them you're doing good, right? You can even do better. You're not going to say you suck. You're a useless piece of. You're not going to say that, right?
Yeah.
So don't say that to your users. That's also the motivation part. So we've had attention and motivation. The third one is also not that hard, ability.
Ability.
Our consciousness has a very scarce mental energy. It depletes, right? So we need to make sure that it's as easy as possible if people are in conscious control of their behavior.
Mm.
So I take out as many field steps as possible. I take out distracting images, right? Just make it as easy as possible. It's also about, you know, let's say chunking is a very easy ability technique, right? Just if you have your checkout form and let's say it's a one page technical solution, just chunk the information that it's logically combined. So your details are your first name, your family name, and then you start with your, let's say if you ask nationality, ask it there, not somewhere else. So we tend to shift around a bit with the things that we're asking. Also on the product page, right, you have this, the very detailed product details, put them all together. It's, you know, because people are finding it more easy. It's what we call with an awkward term, cognitive fluency. It's more easy for people if, you know, if it's chunked in right pieces. So that's if you're dealing with a system two type of audience. Right? They know business to business people that are looking for a very specific product. They're in control of their behavior. And it tends to be a big group, right? I know either somewhere from I think just emerging baby type of science called neuromarketing. Not a big fan of neuromarketing. I love the fact that they can look into the brain, and I love to combine the insights more, but I hate the fact that based on a brain scan or EEG scan, they give advice on how to optimize your page, right? You should always validate that with an A/B test if you can, and please share the results because they still have a lot to learn. So that's system two, right? If you have system one, we only have two types of experiments that we do. And I was going to say neuromarketing has a nonsense saying, which is that 95% of your decisions are made unconsciously. I've tried my best to look up where that comes from, and as far as I can get is that there might have been a professor, I think even at Harvard, I think, that has mentioned that somewhere, but it's not a scientific study. And if you realize that system one is always on, right? Your unconscious brain is always processing information, even while you're asleep, which I think is a good thing, because if you have a fire at house, you will wake up and you will be able to save your life. But it's always on. So it's either 100%, right? Or if they mean that in 5% of the times, your consciousness is controlling your unconsciousness, I think that's way too little. Because as soon as you start separating people from their money, it becomes important for them. They have to justify their decision probably to their partner. And you bet system two is woken up.
They better be, otherwise they'll be dead meat. They're trying to kill them.
Yeah. And it's not like, I'm also not so, I love Cialdini for, you know, Cialdini with the bias.
Cialdini.
Robert Persuasion. Cialdini with the six bias and heuristics. Yeah, he said, you know, he brought psychology into marketing, and I thank him so much for that. But folks, if you start with applying these more system one insights, yeah, you can start with Cialdini's six principles or seven. He added one lately. But it's just a start, right? There are hundreds of these biases and heuristics, and they don't fit into six main ones.
Yeah, I mean, this is a start. I think Cialdini's work is a starting platform. Maybe system one, system two for, you know, CROs just starting out. And, you know, it's really good you're highlighting these things.
System one part is not so hard. So you have this, you did your pre-analysis. You're aware that there's a large group that's, you know, probably not so much in control because they're all over the place. And maybe the timing of the day, etc. We have only two. It's emotions and what we call choice architecture.
Yes.
Or nudges. Emotions, for me as a behavioral scientist are, I find it a bit hard because we nowadays, because of Kahneman, put them in system one, but it might actually be a separate entity because we are aware of our emotions. We can even ask people about their emotions, right? So if people start feeling uncertain or they have a feeling of missing out, they are aware of it, which makes it sort of in between, right? Because since you are aware, it's also a system two conscious thing. But anyway, nonetheless, we put emotions on the system one or almost system one side. And you have to find out for your type of business what emotions are most important. And I think two of them are really interesting to mention: uncertainty, because we see that as soon as people are further down the funnel, right, in there, they're almost starting to buy the product, we see uncertainty rising. And uncertainty is about, you know, is it the right size? When will it be delivered? Can I return it without any cost? Blah, 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 blah. So any experiment that focuses on reducing uncertainty it tends to be in the e-commerce world a very big field. We have a lot of clients where we don't even call the emotions as a dimension. We just call it uncertainty so that they first focus on the uncertainty part. But if you're if you have a social platform, fear of missing out might be like the main emotional driver that you could do a lot of experiments with. That's the emotional part. And then we get to the real system one type of experiments, which we call choice architecture, nudges. These are typically all the biases and heuristics, starting with maybe the Cialdini 6 or 7, but continued with, there's a very nice Wikipedia page on cognitive biases and heuristics. There are hundreds of these effects. And the funny thing is, there's not a real model for it. So we find it harder to apply things if there's no model. But on the other hand, they all work, and they all work together. There's not a bias overload that you can use. Our unconscious part of the brain is able to process massive amounts of information. It's like 180 degrees different from our consciousness that can only deal with one thing at a time. Our unconsciousness can do with a million things at a time. So you can just test all these biases and heuristics and find a lot of winners. Now, just to wrap it up, I dealt with 5 behavioral drivers or dimensions, which are categorized as system 1 and system 2. They are on the system 2 sides: attention, motivation, and ability, right? Sort of BJ Fogg. And on the system 1 side, we have emotions and choice architecture, biases and heuristics. We have a database of all our experiments categorized to these 5 and all the underlying persuasion tactics. Guess which one of these 5 brings us the highest winner percentage?
I'm not sure, actually.
Well, it's the system 1 uttermost choice architecture, the biases and heuristics, the nudges, that has a very significant higher winner ratio than all other 4. So attention, motivation, ability, and emotions tend to be around the same level, right?
Yep.
And our level is slightly higher than most others because we apply these behavioral insights. But choice architecture is significantly higher. So if we would have a winner ratio of, let's say, 35% at a client, the choice architecture is typically 50%.
Mm.
And again, if you realize that only 10% better IDs, right, is already bringing you 40% more growth, imagine what this significant difference does, right? So we are able to shift companies' attention in their experimental program towards way more testing all these biases and heuristics, right? And not every company, because some companies are dealing with very rational users, B2B. Let's say you are a plumber and you're looking for a very specific type. That's very goal-directed. Oh, it could also be a habit, by the way. Anyway, so it's not the same for everything. But typically, in e-commerce side, right, we find this, and then people start more testing these unconscious effects, and it's a very, I think, everyone turns into a behavioral scientist in the end, because it brings you more money, it brings you more enthusiasm, more winners, right, and a lot more knowledge and things to talk about with your family, friends, and colleagues, if you realize that that's where most winners are.
Yeah, I mean, in the experiments that we're running, I'm definitely understanding that system 1 choice architecture is quite a huge ratio of the test winners that we've encountered. I think there was a guy that wrote a book called Nudge. I have that book on my Audible. I haven't listened to it yet. But I've heard it's pretty good. So
Absolutely, yeah. It's a, and I think also a funny thing is it's Sunstein and Thaler that wrote that book, right? And Sunstein is actually a, I think he's a lawyer, or so.
Oh, really?
So they also deal with the, yeah, the more lawyer and ethical side of things, which might be a nice little bridge towards, I think, another topic that we wanted to talk about.
If you have time, we could talk about the last topic we discussed before the podcast, which is the ethics of, you know, influence behavior at scale. You've made note of this, that you know, this is probably a new kind of field of moral awareness of what kind of experience experiments that we're doing and to what audiences. And could you please enlighten our audiences about this area that you're, you know, promoting?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm very involved nowadays in with the government and the authorities that are looking over our markets to set up guidelines and handbooks on how to apply all this knowledge. The basic point about ethics in our field is that most unethical practices are happening unintended and unaware.
Mm.
And I think this really accounts for like at least 98% of the things we're doing. So of course there are a few bad boys, and maybe in some countries there are more bad boys and girls and anything else. But since we are doing so many experiments and influencing people at scale in the digital market scene, there are also happening a lot of negative hurting side effects, but without the mass market being aware and without having the attention to do it. I'll just give you one or two A/B test examples from our own practice, right?
Yeah.
So this is, I think, one of the very nice things to work with true behavioral scientists in your teams is that they are, I think, slightly more early aware of possible negative side effects. And they studied behavioral science, so they are also very aware of how easy it is to influence people in a positive, but of course also in a negative way. So let me give you an example. We ran an experiment with a telco. It was on the page where you have to choose your plan. They have like 6 or 7 plans, and they go from cheap to expensive, and from a few gigabytes to a lot of gigabytes, right?
Yeah.
So we tried an experiment based on the anchoring theory. If you switch it around, you go from expensive to cheap.
Yep.
And from a lot of gigabytes to a few gigabytes, you're probably going to influence the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption was, I think actually the experiment was the other way around, but it doesn't really matter. The assumption was that if you start with the expensive one, right, then on average, they will choose a more expensive plan because, yeah, you know, if they saw 40 euros a month and then they see 35 and 30, it becomes cheaper. Every step is already cheaper.
Because they saw the dearer one first due to the anchoring effect.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you switch it around and you start with 10 euros and you go up, I don't know the exact plan rates, but 10, and then 15 is already more expensive. 20 is already more expensive. So it becomes, on average, they choose a cheaper plan, was our assumption. But the assumption was also that because you anchor on the cheaper plans, you might get actually more clients to choose for your brand, because this was one of the prime, more expensive brands in the Netherlands, right? Or actually in Europe. But we ran the experiment in the Netherlands. So yep, we ran the experiment, and this is exactly what we found. We found with the anchoring on a small number, so the cheaper plan first, we got more clients, but with a average lower plan. If we did the calculations for them, new clients are very important because you can onboard them in your TV services, internet at home services, you know, all the television program services. You have a new client and you can sort of start building from there. So it's way more valuable to have a new client than a slightly higher plan. So that was the winning variation. with the smaller number first. We've been working for this client for a long period already, and we've identified and are analyzing what we call vulnerable segments always. So one of the vulnerable segments is everyone under 18, so adolescents, because you know they have a monthly amount of money to spend, let's say like 25 euros that they get from their parents, and it includes, or maybe 50, I don't know, it includes their telco plan very often, which is like maybe it's a substantial part of their money, right, that they have every month. And they don't have so much money. So for us, it's a vulnerable segment. We did the analysis 6 weeks after, because we first have to get the data in, and we have to, so they bought the product, and they still then have to use the product. And then we analyze all these negative side effects. And we found a what we call in science shocking bill effect, meaning you went over your data. And I'm not going to say you how much it was, but it was really shocking. It was a these kids really had problems. They would not be able to pay for it with their 1 month money. So they all had to go to their parents and say, I'm sorry, but I bought a too cheap plan. And we thought like this, okay, this is a pretty negative side effect. So we went to this client, to the executives, and we said, like, so we saw this in the data. Mm-hmm. We can do two things, and then we can do three things. We can leave it as it is. We can roll back the experiment, or we can do another randomized control trial purely on this group to find more evidence that this effect is really happening. And I think the very cool thing, because I have lots of, I think I have over 50 examples of that we went to a client with showing them a negative hurting effect like this. And every time, they have rolled back the experiment. So if you look at this telco now, it's the higher, the most expensive plan first, although they know it's costing them clients, they don't want to have this effect on the adolescents. Right, and this is my point about ethics. There's no such thing as a dark pattern. I love the dark pattern website.org. Please have a look at there, how you can sort of mislead people, manipulate them. But I want to emphasize, it's not the psychological tactic usually that's unethical, it's the effect that you have. It's also not your intention. Well, if you have a bad intention, okay, chances are very likely that it's unethical, but even there are also ways, no, anyway, but if you have a good intention,
yeah,
and then it doesn't matter what technique you're using, as long as the effect is good. Like my wife is her specialism is sexual abuse and violence, right? Mm-hmm. She's working with people in war zones, right? A lot of these, mostly women, tend to be reluctant to go into therapy. She uses tactics that we would typically identify as a dark pattern to get them into therapy, but in the end, they tend to treat it. They don't have nightmares anymore. They're able to sleep again. They don't walk around like witches anymore. So the effect is really good, but she needs to get them into therapy, right? So she would typically say, like, the Dutch government or your insurance, if you have one, is paying for your therapy. So there are no costs involved. It's not true, because you have to go into a clinic, and you do have to pay for your food and maybe even for your bed. So there are costs involved, right? I would call this a bait and switch technique. You're saying it's cheaper than it is, and it's a dark pattern.
It works though. It's a classic pattern that works. The good old bed and switch.
Yeah. And she uses it, and I don't think it's unethical, because she's treating people, and you know, typically this type of trauma is very easy to treat, because it's only one time trauma. So you get my point, right?
Yeah, I get your point though. The end result is that she's helping these patients out.
Yeah, but I want the CRO scene to be aware that in this massive amount of experiments that you have out there, if you start digging into the data, especially to vulnerable segments, or if you have possible negative side effects, you will actually find a lot of examples where you might have hurt people, right? Where you might have brought them into financial trouble, or where you might have ended people fighting over decisions they made. And it's up to you to look in the mirror whether you're fine with it. There's a lot of cultural differences. Even within my company, some of the experiments that we analyze, you know, some people will say, like, I don't think this is good. I think this, another one, people say, no. People are also, you know, should be more in control of their behavior. There's a lot of discussion around it. But at least do the analysis, talk about it. And if you're not at an agency side, but a company side, you have norms and values there, right? That you're living by as a corporate company. And bringing up these insights really helps to get your CRO efforts to the board level, because you're having discussions about your clients and things you're doing to them. And if you have a little bit of client-centric company, it shows the value not only by optimizing a click-through rate or a conversion rate of a web page, but of the fact that we are truly unveiling what drives clients and customers to choose for our goal. But even in light of the purpose of the company and the norms and values of the company, you're starting to talk the executive C-suite language then, right? For us, it's a very easy way to get it there. And I think we should do that more. Use it beyond the level of increasing CTRs and CRs on pages.
I think you've added another dimension to our role as, you know, CROs or experimenters, that, you know, we do play a huge responsibility to our audiences, to doing good in the world and not just focusing just on dollar at all costs. And this is I'm guessing this is an ongoing conversation. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. Bart, we've talked a lot about that a lot of experiments out there aren't really real.
Any remaining questions, right? It's very easy to find me on LinkedIn, Bart Schultz, without an L. I don't care if it's about, you know, finding the optimal alpha level to listen to your boss better and, you know, don't miss out on any real sales IDs anymore. If it's about rethinking experimental design, maybe that's a step that we're all going to do in only 1 or 2 years. But if you're one of the front leaders and you would love to learn more about it, please contact me. If you want to apply behavioral science, please read the books. Or follow one of the courses that are out there. I do a course on CXL. If you're into the ethical part of things, just first start digging into the data. And if you find anything, please share it, because this is one of the aspects that really drives me as a behavioral scientist in this world of digital experimentation. Absolutely.
Thanks. It's a very in-depth podcast and a lot of food for thought. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you another time. Thank you.
Thank you.